We're unlocking the wonders of the gut microbiome and exploring its outsized significance on our health on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is a lot to learn about that bustling community of trillions of microorganisms that live in our digestive system. Some scientists refer to the gut microbiome as an organ. It's both inherited and essential. Some use a term like super organ or supporting organ. Whatever you call it, join in on Gut Health, 800-642-1234. Noel Mueller is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, studies the determinants of gut microbiota and how they can be leveraged to prevent disease. He's a Wisconsin native, hails from Burlington. Noel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me on your show.
Good morning. Well, can you take us on a tour first of the digestive system and who are these trillions of microorganisms that live there?
Sure. Thank you. I'll go ahead and just give a little introduction to the microbiome. So I'll speak specifically here about the gut microbiome. So over the last two decades or so, owing to the emergence of rapid expansion of high throughput genetic sequencing technology, there's been a number of discoveries that have given way to an extended view of ourselves. We're realizing that we're not only our own eukaryotic cells, but we're also comprised of microbial counterparts that live on our body, on our skin, on all of our body surfaces, all of the epithelia, and also in our intestinal tract, in our guts. So our bodies are really host to this whole composite of microbial communities, and the ensemble of those microbial communities are termed the microbiota or the microbiome. While bacteria are the most abundant and the most studied of the microorganisms, there are also emerging lines of evidence and investigation into other microorganisms, including fungi, archaea, and also the virome is another hot area of investigation.
But what I'm hearing is each one is unique to an individual person, almost like our fingerprints, if you will.
You know, that's a good point. So we share the majority of our genes, we actually share in common with our, neighbors around us that you walk around next to. Over 99% of genes are shared in common. But we actually have quite discordance in terms of the types of bacteria that we host on our bodies between you and your, average neighbor. So only about 40% of bacteria are shared with your, on average, somebody who's your same age and sex. So it is more distinct than your own genome is from your neighbor. And that has given kind of some hint that they may be contributing to the phenotypic or disease differences between you and somebody else, or, other differences, just in terms of your host physiology and how your body works.
How do these microbes get there in the first place?
You know, that's a great question. We've done a lot of investigation on this. And I started doing research on this in 2014 when I was a postdoc at Columbia University working with Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello. And at the time, there was a study that came out in a high impact journal suggesting that there might be a placenta microbiome and in utero sharing of microbes. However, since that study came out, it's been dispelled. This myth about this in utero sharing of microbes has largely been dispelled. And what we've learned through some of our research is that the first major exposure to bacteria and microorganisms actually comes at the time of birth through either the breaking of water or through the vaginal delivery process, if it's a natural delivery. And there's a colonization of microorganisms that happens to the newborn at that time. And that colonization is probably quite important for the health of the baby, to train the immune system early on, to also provide the baby with pioneering bacteria that can help to break down certain components of human breast milk, such as human milk oligosaccharides, which otherwise our bodies would not be able to break down and use for energy. And those bacteria that first colonize our body are also important for providing us with essential minerals and vitamins that we wouldn't otherwise be able to create.
I'm just going to reintroduce you here as we explore the science behind what is happening with these trillions of microorganisms living in our digestive system. Noel Mueller is an associate professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, taking your questions about gut health, 800-642-1234. In the pandemic, Noel, we've been extra vigilant of wiping down surfaces with these wipes that kill germs, and we've been sudsing up with antibacterial soap and all that. What does that mean for our gut microbiome health? Does it have an impact?
You know, that's a great question, Kate. We wrote an editorial a couple of years ago before the pandemic on the association of household detergents and cleaners and the impact that they have on the infant microbiome. So households that tended to use more antibiotic detergents for household cleaning products, those mother-child pairs, the child tended to have a less diverse microbiome and some evidence of more pathobiontic or potentially harmful bacteria in their microbiome. So that was early evidence before the pandemic that household detergents with antibiotics could have an effect on the diversity and membership of the microbiome. Now we've gone through the pandemic and washing surfaces in our hands frequently has just become commonplace. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that that's going to have an effect also on our microbiome. However, we need to think about trade-offs here and trading off, reducing potential transmission of SARS-CoV-2 is likely something that we would prefer over, worrying about reducing certain species in our microbiome that are commensal or symbiotic species. Hmm. I think it's, something we want to just keep in mind, not to overuse these types of detergents that might kill some of our commensal and symbiotic bacteria. But if it can potentially reduce SARS-CoV-2, I think that that's something that we also want to make sure we keep in mind.
It seems as if scientists more and more have this growing body of knowledge about these microbes and about gut health. How can gut microorganisms be used to actually fine-tune, if you will, the immune system? What effect does it have on the immune system?
So, yeah, as I mentioned before, at the beginning of life, we're born as essentially a clean slate and we're exposed to microorganisms at the very beginning of life. And those exposures to different types of bacteria are training our immune system to determine who's our friends and who's our foes and how should our immune system react to these different types of microorganisms when they encounter them later in life. So the immune system is quite complex and we're still learning exactly how these different types of commensal and symbiotic bacteria are influencing our immune system. So beyond just immune outcomes, there may be also a crosstalk between the bacteria and immune metabolic outcomes, such as obesity. So if you're an obese mother giving birth to your child, you're probably sharing with your child a different set of microbes that may have different effects on the child. And that may be in part through the immune system, which we're starting to just understand now. So there's a lot of things that are potentially going on that we're trying to still understand mechanistically. But there's, I would say that the potential for the influence of the microbiome is quite large, and we just need more research. It's still recent, pretty recent that we've begun to have longitudinal studies in large enough sample size to be able to ask some of these important questions.
To drill down on it, yes. Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Noel Mueller, our guide to the science of gut health, what scientists are discovering. Join in on the gut microbiome, what to make of the claims you hear about probiotics, about the talk around obesity and the gut microbiome. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Noel Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're learning how to improve our gut health on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cherkant. So there was a recent study in the journal Nutrients that says to add cayenne pepper to our cooking because of capsaicin, the natural compound that gives all peppers that spicy kick. It also could be linked to good gut health. Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Noel Mueller studies the microbiome and is with us for the hour. Let's bring on Richard now in True Rivers. Richard, hi, what is your question?
Yeah, thanks for taking my phone call, Kate. I've had a question that's been puzzling me for a while. I'm wondering if you could overdo it because, for example, I wake up in the middle of the night and I have to go to the bathroom and my mouth is dry. So I drink a whole 16-ounce bottle of kombucha, then I go to work, and I usually mix kefir with ice. I drink that throughout the day, and I just want to know if you can overdo it.
Richard, thank you. Noel, what do you make of that?
Richard, that's an excellent question. So kombucha is, you know, one of those drinks that I think tastes quite good, but the research on kombucha is pretty limited, just because kombucha can consist of many different types of microorganisms that they're not really produced in a manner that's tailored for health per se. They're a little bit more wild, as we would say, and there's different varieties of kombucha. So I like to think of the microbiome, you know, in general as like food, that not all food is good for us. Some types are better for us than others. Same with microbes. Not all microbes are potentially good for our guts. So we want to be cognizant of the types of microbes that we're introducing if we're trying to help our digestive tract with certain conditions that we're dealing with. So you probably, you know, want to be careful with the amount of kombucha that you're taking in. Kefir is a naturally occurring, what they call postbiotic type of beverage that's been around for a long time and probably has even more of a good safety profile in terms of the types of microorganisms that are going to be found in kefir. So I think that there's probably more potential evidence for health benefits from kefir. But with kombucha, it's a little bit of a, you know, wild, wild west situation where there's not much regulation. It's considered by the FDA as a generally recognized as safe beverage that you can buy over the counter, but you shouldn't expect that that's going to necessarily cure your GI symptoms. What you might want to consider doing is talking to your clinician, explaining what you have going on. They can discuss with you potential options and then say, you know, you're interested in trying out potentially some types of probiotics or symbiotics to see if they could help with your GI health. And they might be able to come up with some options for you that could help with some of the symptoms that you're dealing with. But I think it is worth, you know, considering overdoing it is a possibility.
Richard, thank you. You mentioned probiotics, and there's been that huge marketing push over the past decade or so to, you know, try these yogurts and other food brands pushing probiotics. What is behind that? What does that do for us?
So, you know, Kate, that's a great question. Probiotics have been around for a long time, and the level of evidence for probiotics also has historically not been that great because, first of all, we haven't been that interested in our guts. It's only been, you know, over the last two decades or so that we've really had the sequencing technology that has allowed us the lens into what microbes are good or bad for our health, and we're starting to better understand that. Probiotics have been around longer than that and have also been the types of bacteria that are easiest to culture and provide in a probiotic form, you know, such as a pill. Whereas now we're also advancing in our ability to produce and distribute probiotics that can consist of anaerobic bacteria, you know, bacteria that were more difficult to grow in the past. And we can actually, you know, say, take the R&D that we've been doing over the last two decades and say, what are the types of microorganisms that we want to test and see whether they're going to help prevent disease? And so there's a new wave of probiotics that will be going through clinical trials and looking at a number of different maladies, diseases, And I think we should have some better evidence of whether those live kind of biotherapeutics can help us with our GI symptoms, a whole host of different types of diseases.
People take supplements, vitamins for a lot of different things. What about a probiotic supplement? Do they do anything? Are they there yet?
You know, similar to vitamins and minerals, which the evidence is actually quite poor for multivitamins in terms of improving your health. And that's something that many people don't actually pick up on, is that the evidence for multivitamin use and most morbidity and mortality is not great, but people still take vitamins and minerals. The same for probiotics is true. Like I said before, there's a lot of heterogeneity in the types of probiotics that you can find over the counter. Mm-hmm. And you really want to do your homework and think about what you're interested in introducing to your system, because not all probiotics are necessarily going to be good for your GI health. And you may be able to actually improve your GI health more through consuming fruits and vegetables, if you can tolerate that, if you don't have IBS, for example, whole grains, more of a Mediterranean style diet. Those are considered prebiotics mm-hmm. that nurture your microbiome. And that actually might be a more kind of well-established approach to fostering a healthy microbiome than trying to introduce new microbes that may or may not even stick around in your gut.
We have Johns Hopkins University Noel Mueller as we answer your questions about the gut microbiome. Let's go to Ed in McFarland. Ed, hi, go ahead.
Hello. So I have seen services or companies out there offering the service of assessing your own microbiome. I don't know exactly how they do it, but they will assess your microbiome and then offer how the health, give you a rating of some sort on how healthy it is, and even offer dietary guidance on how to improve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's, what is your comments on that? Are they accurate? Is there something to that? And then real quick, the second one, prior to a colonoscopy, you clean your colon. Does that have any impact on your microbiome? I'm thinking it might have a negative impact. If you could comment on that. Thank you.
Ed, thank you. Questions one and two there. Noel, go ahead.
Great. Yep. Thank you for the call, Ed, and the question. The first question, so I think that you need to be careful again with the information that you would get from these types of companies that are going to be testing and telling you whether or not the microbiome that you have is associated with disease states or other types of kind of physiology about your body. Similar to 23andMe in the early days, the information about your genes and diseases is based on probability. And the probability comes from the evidence that, the current evidence, which generally comes from observational studies. And observational studies are, large, usually, hopefully prospective studies that tell you whether or not this particular gene, if it's 23andMe, or this particular microorganism has been associated with some disease. But, if it's a good company, they'll also tell you that that is just an association, and that's causal. Mm. And they should give you some kind of range of the uncertainty in that suggestion, okay? But it may be something that's beneficial to understand your gut microbiome, to see who's there, and to see whether those species are species that break down different types of fibers in your food, or break down red meat if you're a red meat consumer. There's certain types of bacteria that, because we have the clinical trials, the feeding studies, we do know that these bacteria have these functions, mm-hmm. and it can give you some indication into your diet, your lifestyle. Also your sleep is probably affecting your microbiome, and potentially, we're going to continue to learn more that these types of services, sequencing your gut microbiome and providing you with information about risk for diseases and your lifestyle habits, they can be more and more informative as we continue to learn more.
We're gonna just pause there on the question around the colonoscopy. And as we focus on the gut microbiome with Noel Mueller of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, works on research in this area, scientists trying to uncover the inner workings of the gut microbiome, and sharing your questions and curiosities as well. We'll pick this up with Noel Mueller after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a healthy gut on The Morning Show and how scientists are starting to see connections to fighting disease, boosting immunity, potentially preventing obesity, and more connections. I'm very interested in whether coffee and tea are good for our gut microbiome, especially black tea, because just like clockwork, I drink 2 cups each morning. Maybe you have certain breakfast foods, drinks that you wonder are associated with gut health and the microbiome. 800-642-1234. Noel Mueller is an associate professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health with us for the hour. Noel, let's go to Ed's second part on the colonoscopy. And when you consume all the clear liquids and you avoid solids and do all that prep for the colonoscopy and emptying the colon, what impact does that have on the gut microbiome?
Yeah, great question from Ed. So there was actually a study done on this very question, and it compared a group with prep and no prep. And measure their microbiome before and after treatment, and then also took it 14 days after recovery from the treatment. And what they found was that the PrEP did indeed have a large effect on the microbiome and the metabolome, which are the metabolites that the microbiome produce. Immediately, it had an acute effect. However, after 14 days, fortunately, the microbiome and the metabolome, the metabolites that are produced, recovered. You know, almost all of the different microbes that were affected by the PrEP recovered to pre-PrEP levels. So that's something that we can kind of take solace in, that likely this PrEP is not going to have a drastic long-lasting effect, but has an acute effect that goes away.
It's interesting to know that the body bounces back like that, that that community of microbes can really bounce back. It means there's a lot of resiliency there.
Yeah, you know, microbes, there is resiliency. Microbes establish a niche after about age of 2 or 3 years, after, you know, we get through those first 2 or 3 years of life, our microbiome becomes a little bit more stable. And there are ways that we can disrupt our microbiome through, you know, antibiotic use and through major dietary changes and through different medications that can disrupt the microbiome. And each disruption, subsequent disruptions, can have greater effects. Hmm. So if you take one course of antibiotics and then get back to your habitual diet, you're likely going to see that most of the microbiota are going to recover quite well. Hmm. But if you have to take several courses of antibiotics, the chances are that some of the species will get depleted or even extinct. Sometimes it has to do with the number of insults to your microbiome that are repeated, because the, you know, the resiliency can be affected by the number of different insults, and that can have a long lasting effect. But otherwise, if you have, you know, one type of medical intervention like antibiotics or some types of medications or this bowel prep for colonoscopy, and you get back to your normal lifestyle, likely your microbiome is going to bounce back quite well.
touching again on the infant microbiome as shaped by the mode of birth and C-sections. Anne from Brooklyn called in, couldn't stay with us, and Anne wants to know how C-sections might impact the microbiomes of newborn babies and what could be perhaps responsible for health issues later in life.
Yes, so that's a great question. So we've actually done a bit of research on the effects of C-section delivery on both the microbiome and also on some disease phenotypes later in life. So as I mentioned before, the very beginning of life is when babies are getting seeded with their first microbes. If you have a natural vaginal delivery, the types of microbes that you're being seeded with include Bifidobacterium longum infantis. This is a type of bacteria that has been well studied and has benefits to the infant. It's a keystone species that can break down human milk oligosaccharides, which are prebiotics, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Prebiotics are the types of foods that can be that the microbes can feed off of. And human milk oligosaccharides are this really special type of compound that's found in mammalian breast milk, and humans have the most of it, but can only be broken down by bacteria. When you're delivered by C-section, you have lower amounts of Bifidobacteria infantis in your intestinal tract. So potentially you have less ability to break down some of those human milk oligosaccharides than a vaginally delivered baby would. In lieu of Bifidobacteria, you have higher proportions of pathobiontic bacteria, which are more proteobacteria that can cause different GI distresses. Also potentially can lead to different types of infections. On average, not all C-section delivered babies are like this, but that's just on average what we find with the evidence. Also, we have found that C-section delivery is associated. So C-section delivered babies have a slightly higher risk of several disease outcomes. So there's been associations of C-section delivery with higher risk of obesity. We found at age 7, about a 45% higher risk of obesity. They also have been found to have higher risk of asthma and certain allergies. Now, whether those associations are causal or due to some other indication for why the mother had the C-section delivery, that's still being kind of teased out. But what we're trying to do now is to understand whether the sharing of microbiota at the beginning of life can be used in C-section delivered babies to restore the microbes that they would have gotten from their vaginal birth. So C-section delivered babies don't get those microbiota from their mother, but if we find a way to seed the microbiota with the mother's bacteria, can we reverse that microbiome development and potentially the risk for C-section associated diseases? So we're right now embarking on a trial, clinical trial, to test whether that's true. But I just want to make sure that the, you know, the listeners are aware that you shouldn't try this at home, because there are potential risks of sharing your own, for example, vaginal microbiome with your baby at birth. You know, if you have some underlying, you have, you know, a dysbiosis or an imbalance of bacteria in your vaginal microbiome, or if you have, you know, herpes or bacterial vaginosis or group B streptococcus, you want to avoid sharing those types of microorganisms with your baby because you might be able to transmit them. So wait till the study's done. Sorry about that.
That's okay. It's such an interesting thing to know that these are the types of studies that are underway. Talking with Johns Hopkins' Noel Mueller as we answer your questions about the gut microbiome from infant to adult. And let's go to Steve now in Stoughton with a question on how eating meat impacts the gut microbiome. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. What an interesting topic for a Monday morning, get the brain going. You kind of touched on my question around antibiotics in meat and other food products. So I think you answered that, indicating that antibiotics can have an impact on the gut biome. So I guess I would like to ask this question instead. Is there research being done as new antibiotics are being developed to see if they have impacts on the gut biome?
Steve, thank you.
Steve, that's a great question. I'm not going to be able to fully answer that because, you know, development of new antibiotics has been slower than we would have hoped for, but there is a push from large pharmaceutical companies to start to make that more of a priority because of antibiotic resistant genes that are in the environment and quite worrisome also. Antibiotic overuse has historically been a big problem, not only in the US, but in other countries. And so there's a movement towards stewardship and using less antibiotics and also development of new antibiotics to keep up with the antibiotic resistant types of microorganisms. I don't know the research on how these new types of antibiotics affect the microbiome, but in general, a more narrow spectrum antibiotic likely is going to have a more narrow effect on the microbiome than a broad spectrum antibiotic.
What might the impact be of a heavy meat diet on the human microbiome?
Great question. So your diet does affect your microbiome pretty strongly. It's usually one of the strongest factors that's associated with the microbiome. And some of the studies that you'll see, you know, try to account for this by having people self-report their diet, but other types of studies actually feed participants all the foods in their diet. And those can give us the best insight into how diet is affecting the microbiome. So there's been, you know, multiple studies that have fed people different types of diets and found that you can have a drastic effect on your microbiome over just a couple of days if you switch from a plant-based diet to an animal-based or meat-based diet. And so there's an overall large effect that can happen on the microbiome. And that not only affects the microbiome, but also the metabolites that the microbiome produces. And those metabolites are usually the small molecules that have the effect on your human body from your intestinal tract. And they also get circulated throughout your body and can have effects on different organisms. So one type of metabolite that has shown quite strong evidence for having an effect on heart disease is trimethylamine oxide. And this is called TMAO, also TMAO. And it's been shown in mouse models and also in human studies to be associated and potentially causally associated with heart disease development. And TMAO is produced from the microbial breakdown of red meats. And it's something that, you know, if you're interested in living long and preventing heart disease, you might want to keep an eye on if you're a big red meat eater. Or you could just start to follow more of a plant-based diet and make red meat a small part of your diet. You know, if you don't want to eliminate it completely, just make it a smaller part of your plate.
Just pull back on it. Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Noel Mueller is with us on the science of gut health, how scientists are making strides in this area. Let's take a moment and then talk more with Noel Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation about our digestive system and the gut microbiome on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists are drawing more and more links between gut microbiota and our health. There was this new study by the University of Pittsburgh found that microbes in the guts of lab mice influence what they choose to eat by creating substances that prompt cravings for different kinds of foods. Johns Hopkins epidemiologist Noel Mueller is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in David now in Germantown. David, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Oh, I just wanted to know, emulsifiers, food additives have been pretty strongly implicated in causing inflammatory changes in the gut, even to the point of causing or contributing to inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis. Research, I just wanted to know what your opinion is on the research and how do you avoid those because they're in everything.
Thank you, David.
Hi, David. Thank you for that question. There was a great seminar that was given at Johns Hopkins recently on emulsifiers, and mostly the research was done in mice, because it's easier to experimentally control your two groups, to have a group that's exposed to emulsifiers or not. Because as you mentioned, emulsifiers are ubiquitous in the food supply. It's hard to avoid them. It's also hard to study them using the types of dietary assessment tools that we have in large observational studies, where we get a lot of the evidence for associations. So I think that, you know, there is likely a strong link between emulsifiers and alterations in the microbiome. This comes from experimental mouse models, some suggestion also from humans, but there needs to be better and more research on controlled human trials to really see what species of bacteria are being altered by emulsifiers, whether those changes in the microbiome that are caused by emulsifiers are leading to conditions such as ulcerative colitis, IBS, IBD, because as you mentioned, you know, there's some pretty intriguing evidence out there, and I think those need to be confirmed with human studies.
What do the emulsifiers do in the food that we eat, generally speaking?
So emulsifiers are used in the food to hold food together and keep them, you know, in the kind of the form and the composition that we like to consume them in. So a lot of highly processed foods contain emulsifiers. So one way of kind of avoiding emulsifiers is getting back to eating whole foods that, you know, are actually something, you know, fruits and vegetables, for example, or whole grains that are not highly processed foods. One thing we know pretty well is that highly processed foods are not good for overall health, nor are they good for the microbiome. So trying to follow a diet that's more rich in whole foods that are not highly processed is one way to kind of avoid emulsifiers.
We heard from Tyler in an email, watched a documentary called Fantastic Fungi. It's about mushrooms and the impact of mental health, body health, cancer treatment, and wants to know, are you aware of any research or applications of fungi in the sphere of the gut microbiome?
Great question, Tyler. There is actually some research going on at Hopkins. Hopkins is one of the first centers to initiate studies of psilocybin, the active component of mushrooms, and the effects that it has on mental health and also on other aspects of health, including addiction to smoking and addiction to alcohol. And there is now NIH, National Institute of Health, funding to support that research, which is a breakthrough because there's been a moratorium on research on psilocybin for many years since Nixon was president. And now we're finally starting to come back to see that there's potential health benefits of studying these compounds. Again, this awaits future results to see whether the effects are beneficial and outweigh any potential risk. But to your question about whether or not there's any evidence of whether these compounds affect the microbiome, as far as I'm concerned, there's not. I have had some discussions with my colleagues who are at the center at Hopkins that's doing this research, and they're starting to collect stool specimens from some of the participants to see whether or not the psilocybin would have an effect on the microbiome and whether the microbiome may modify the effect of psilocybin on some of the outcomes.
Another email along the way here. Julie wants to know about laxatives and how Miralax, other laxatives impact the gut microbiome. What is known there?
You know, Julie, that's a great question. Similar to kind of the pre-treatment for colonoscopies, I think that laxatives can have an acute effect on your microbiome. But if you're only using them, you know, very rarely, hopefully your microbiome is going to bounce back. Unless there's a medical indication for use of the laxatives, I would probably try to avoid using them because I don't think we really understand fully the long-term effects that they might have on the microbiome or your health. And they can also deplete you of getting the nutrients that you need from the foods you're consuming. So that's a little bit of, I don't really know exactly how it's affecting the microbiome, but likely it's one of those things you want to stay away from using too frequently.
Let's go to Lucas now in Jefferson. Lucas, what is your question? What would you like to bring up?
Okay, thanks for taking my call. So yeah, I actually had a friend in college who had shingles pretty young, and he had antibiotic treatment, which actually wiped out his gut health. And then he actually got C. diff from that as well. So we touched on the fact that probiotic yogurts or like kombucha can replenish gut bacteria or gut biota, but he actually got a fecal transplant. So I was wondering if you could comment on fecal transplants and the efficacy and use of those.
Yeah, that's a great question. And fecal transplants, for those who are listening who are not aware, are the, you know, you take an entire microbial community from one individual and you transplant it into another individual. Or you can do, you can actually take the microbiota from one individual pre-treatment for, let's say, antibiotics or something else, and then repopulate the microbiome post-treatment with the microbiome from that same individual. So there's different ways of doing this transplant. Fecal transplant has only been approved for C. difficile infection treatment. C. difficile infection is a very nasty infection that can cause major morbidity and even death, and comes after somebody's been exposed usually to multiple rounds of antibiotics to try to treat the C. diff infection. There was a trial in the New England Journal of Medicine that compared fecal transplants to the first-line antibiotic regimen and found that fecal transplants did much better than the antibiotics. It was such a strong effect that they actually had to stop the trial early because there was so much benefit and that they wanted to start to give this to patients with C. difficile. So fecal transplants are being used for C. difficile now more often. But we still don't know whether we should be using fecal transplants for other outcomes because there is a risk of introducing all of these different microbes from a different individual into your microbiome. Those microbes can also cause infections and have other unintended consequences. So before we can start to do this or even think about doing it, we need to really better understand what the types of microbes are in the microbiome and what effect they're having. And a more likely scenario is that we would understand the microbes and then provide them in some type of cocktail of a probiotic or symbiotic where we can control the microorganisms that are being introduced.
And that really leads into just that final look ahead with just a few moments left. What research are you really watching that is most exciting in this area?
Great question. Well, one research project that I'm really excited about is the vaginal seeding project, where we're doing a different type of microbiome transplant to C-section deliver newborns to see whether they can benefit from receiving their maternal or their mother's microbes at the beginning of life, and whether we can restore the microbiome of C-section delivered infants to that of their vaginally delivered counterparts. That's something that's really interesting. I'm also very interested in just understanding how different dietary patterns in a randomized controlled trial can affect the microorganisms in our gut and the metabolites that they produce, and potentially benefit not only our cardiovascular health, but also our cognitive health, and whether we could prevent dementia and other types of neurodegenerative diseases that have been very difficult to prevent and treat.
Noel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to come on anytime.
Noel Mueller, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.